Could it be a new green rush for Florida? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead on the show this morning, a legal victory for cannabis growers and sellers here in Florida. What are your questions? As we talk cannabis on the show right now, it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, marking the 50th anniversary of the moon landing this weekend. All of that and more just ahead. But first, this hour, it's being hailed as a major legal victory for cannabis growers and sellers in the state. Last week, a Florida appellate court ruled that the system set up for distributing medical marijuana around the state is unconstitutional. What does that mean? What can we expect next? We decided to begin the hour with a closer look as we welcome our regular cannabis contributors. Sally Peebles is a partner at Vicente Cederberg, and she serves on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And Shelton Hull, a writer who covers cannabis for Folio Weekly, also here with us.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here, guys. And as we kick off the hour, here's our question to callers. What are your cannabis questions for our in-studio experts? We're going to begin with a new court ruling that could open up the cannabis markets even more. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Already getting your tweets, and we'll go to our Facebook comments too. But first, Sally Peebles, let's begin with you. Last week, a Florida appellate court ruled that vertical integration around this market is unconstitutional. What is vertical integration, and how does that rule the distribution of cannabis in Florida?
Vertical integration means that a licensee in Florida has to control the entire process from seed to sale. So in other states, you and I could go apply to just get a cultivation license or just get a processing license or just dispensing. But in Florida, the statute required that a licensee had to do everything. And the constitutional amendment, the argument is, said that, that a licensee would only be able to do one part of it. So this state could have a massive impact because it now means that the state might have to go back to the drawing board and rewrite the statute, opening it up to horizontal licensing so that a licensee could just do one part of that process.
So people can participate at different parts of the supply chain to make money off this product?
Absolutely. So when you're required to be vertically integrated, it's incredibly expensive. So you and I would have to, you know, get a lease on a dispensary building and a cultivation building. That's a very expensive process. And so, you know, that requires a lot of capital. If you have a horizontal system, that allows the moms and pops to come in because you would just really need rental on a building and some startup costs.
Why was it set up as vertically integrated? Was that a way that the legislature sought to limit the distribution of this product?
So I imagine the argument is, and it is somewhat valid for a new system, and for a government that is a little tepid around the issue. If you have less licenses, it's less expensive to regulate. Okay, so if the state's now faced with issuing hundreds of licenses overnight, it was probably a heavy burden for them to do that, or they thought it would be. So here, there's less licenses to regulate, and less expensive for them to do so. Instead of overseeing hundreds of licenses, you're overseeing 22.
Medical marijuana is legal in the state. A new appellate court ruling could end with more distribution points around Florida. We'll go to your cannabis questions in a moment at 549-2937. Shelton Hull, you write about cannabis regularly. This ruling is being seen as a victory for anyone looking to grow, process, or distribute cannabis-related products. Also a victory for patients?
Oh, sure. It's anything that leads to more competition, more variety, more diversity in the market is a benefit for the patients and for the consumers. A lot of people were complaining early on that the vertical integration market, as Sally said, it's very expensive. And so that the fact that it's so expensive, that kind of skews in the direction of, say, a Caucasian, shall we say. So a lot of my minority friends out there, I'm a minority myself, I am my own friend, they say that...
You're your own friend. That's good to know.
You have to be. You have to be in this world. They say that the way things have been set up so far, it does disproportionately favor white people, and it sort of goes against, like, all the African Americans who are disproportionately put in jail for marijuana convictions. So this new ruling opens the door for more product, a broader variety, not just of the different strains themselves, but of the different products that can be made from it.
And certainly hundreds of thousands of Floridians have taken advantage of the legality of medical marijuana since Amendment 2 passed overwhelmingly to treat what ails them, everything from nausea related to chemotherapy to epilepsy, a whole range of conditions, Sally. At the same time this week, the Florida House sought to intervene in this ruling. What's going on there?
So the Florida House is arguing that while the Department of Health is granted the authority to implement the rules, that the House is really the only party who can implement policy. And their argument is this is a federally illegal drug. It is very difficult to navigate state laws around that federal illegality, and that the House and not the Department of Health is best suited to make that argument. Because right now the Department of Health is the defendant.
Okay, so it's legally complicated and it's not over yet. For people that are listening and trying to follow this, where does this go from here?
So right now, the Department of Health really has two major options, and there's some variations on that option. So, they can appeal to the Supreme Court. They could appeal and request a rehearing en banc, meaning that all the judges have to sit and hear it and not just a limited few, which is what we saw here. They could also seek clarification from the court saying, okay, you're saying it's unconstitutional. What does that mean we need to do? Or the second option really is they just don't appeal. And that means that they are going to have to go back to the drawing board and strategize how to create a system that's in line with the opinion. And that means not vertically integrated. And critically, they also said you cannot cap licenses at the state level, meaning there's no more limit.
Woody tweets the show, I think Florida should just become a legal recreational state. It's going to happen eventually. We should get out in front of it. It's like anything else in life. You want to or you don't want to do it, leave the choice to the individual. Let us know what you think about the future of marijuana in Florida at 549-2937. And Shelton, as this legal fight continues over the distribution of medical marijuana, there is already a move afoot to put a new amendment on the ballot in 2020 to make Florida the next state that legalizes marijuana for recreational use. Is that likely to pass or not?
It's likely to pass. It's more likely to pass than it is to actually get on the ballot. Pretty much every state that's had it up before the voters so far has passed it. You might recall back in the 90s, a number of the states that have passed recently, such as Colorado, Washington State, California, they passed medical marijuana or full decriminalization, and the Supreme Court struck that down in 2001. The Bush administration appealed, saying that the federal government's law trumped the state law. So they went back to the drawing board, and now that's where we're at. The process of getting enough signatures to get this thing on the ballot, last I checked, they're very far behind.
They may not get on the ballot, in other words, because the legislature's made it harder to get these constitutional amendment provisions on the ballot. A lot more signatures are now required.
The legislature's made it harder, but the real problem is that a lot of people in the industry, you're not seeing this groundswell of support to say, for example, you would think that there are a couple of organizations that are doing the petition drive. Normally, you would think that, say, if all three of us were running cannabis companies, we would each kick in $10,000 to make sure they have enough people out there getting signatures full time. But the medical marijuana companies are not doing that so far. John Morgan's not really doing that so far. Maybe they're afraid of competition. This summer is super crucial because it's the festival season, the beaches and whatnot. They have to get, I believe, something like 750,000 signatures by February. And
that's a high bar. It doesn't look like they would necessarily get that, Sally.
Like Sheldon said, this is really a funding issue. And everyone, I get this question a lot. Why are the MMTCs not throwing in? And I think some are, actually. And why don't they have that funding? Why is Morgan not paying? Well, Morgan paid, $10 million, I think, out of his own pocket the first time around to get medical marijuana on the ballot. And he sees maybe someone else, another benefactor, should step in, which is valid. And when it comes to the MMTCs or the existing players, why aren't they funding it fully? Because we probably need about $10 million to get this passed. I mean, if you got to look at the language on Regulate Florida's bill, they may not agree with how it's going to be implemented. I'm not sure of that, but that makes sense. It's usually if I'm going to put $1 million of my own money, I want to make sure that's going toward a goal that I'm completely in line with. And maybe they don't completely agree with the way that Regulate Florida is going to attempt to regulate.
And lots of cannabis questions. Yeah. Meanwhile, it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Dean is on the South Side. Hi, Dean. Good morning.
Hi, I appreciate the conversation. I just wanted to make a comment that it seems to be that the conversation is centering around businesses' rights and that this originally was voted for patients' rights, and that there are markets, you know, elsewhere in other states that do allow patients to grow their own. And I just wanted that to be at least mentioned as sort of a bypass to this entire conversation. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right, Dean. Sally could probably tell you more about the case involving Joe Redner, who's a guy down in Tampa. He was dealing with lung cancer. Thankfully, he's still doing well. But his attorney had recommended that he juice his marijuana. And the doctor recommended something like 4 ounces of marijuana juice per day. Mm. So you can imagine how much that would require in order to generate that much juice.
It's not it's a lot of juice.
It's not a juicy plant.
No.
So he was going to start growing his own, and that is still going through the legal process. I believe now that that patients can grow a little bit of their own to a limited extent, but it's very iffy.
Nikki, it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Nikki in Jacksonville. Hey, Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
My issues is my dad was on hospice, and we could not get any cannabis care. It's supposed to have been passed medically, but being that hospice is federally funded, they're not allowed to recommend, provide, or help with any of it. So, I mean, if we're not changing things on a federal level, are we really changing anything in the long run?
Right. And I'm so sorry you had that issue with your dad and your family, Nikki. Thanks for calling. And she brings up such an important point, Sally Kent Peebles, because as you said a few minutes ago, at the federal level, cannabis is still classified as a Schedule I drug. So there's an enormous disconnect between what the feds are doing and what the states are doing. Although there's been some movement on Capitol Hill to try to resolve that. So at least for the next few years, we're still looking at this legal gray area, aren't we, when it comes to the regulation and distribution of marijuana?
Yeah, the caller's completely right. There's a lot of issues that we just simply aren't going to be able to jump over until marijuana is dealt with at the federal level. We often, you know, get callers about employment issues. I mean, those are the types of things that we're just simply not going to be able to push through without federal involvement, banking issues. But right now at the federal government, there was actually a congressional hearing last week, very exciting, the first time that's happened, talking about what if the federal government decided to legalize, what would that look like? You know, seeing Congress take that step to even get provided
to even
that
discuss
input
it.
Is incredibly, you know, that kind of flew under the radar. But that was one of the most significant days our movement has seen. And right now there's a States Act that is being considered, which would really lift a lot of these federal prohibitions within the states where marijuana is legal.
Okay. Shelton Hall, your thoughts.
Well, on the federal level, it's been a matter of debate for some time. There are decriminalization and legalization bills sort of lurching through the process in the House of Representatives as well as in the Senate. Cory Booker, of course, had the Marijuana Justice Act back in 2017. The issue is, if the bill was done right, it could probably pass in the House. It's unlikely to pass in the Senate with the Republican control, although the president has said on a couple of occasions that if a legalization bill made it to his desk, that he would strongly consider signing it. That would be in fitting with like the positions he was taking years ago when he was in New York. Recently, the House passed an omnibus appropriations bill, and there is a rider on it that would prohibit federal funds from being used to enforce marijuana policy in states that have made it legal. And that's always been a concern, because no matter how legal it is on the state level, the feds can come in, particularly in regard to banking or interstate commerce and whatnot. So removing if you can remove the federal kind of the interdiction powers, shall we say, that opens the door for a lot more business and a lot more freedom for the consumer and the patients.
It's 549-2937. Bill is downtown. Hi, Bill. What are your thoughts? Yeah. Good morning.
Yeah, I think recreational marijuana should be banned. The arguments for it are specious. Most people are in hospice that are on the caller, and I do feel bad about that. But those are handled. You can handle that with a cut version of morphine. If the patient is not going to make it in their terminal, you can do a cut morphine and get the patient 100% relief. It's perfectly fine. They do this at very, very low cost, and they do it in Africa. The second thing is, like you say, there's a mismatch between federal and state law. State, let's say, goes ahead, passes a law, everybody can smoke it. Then a bunch of feds come in and scoop everybody up. The third thing is, do you want a population that's totally baked all the time? Now they have access to marijuana. They can drink. And then you want them to operate machinery and be your surgeons. You want to be your pilots who have this opportunity, who really can't control themselves now. Now you want to add one extra thing to it. I think that's a big mistake at a fundamental level.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. So he's laying out all the arguments against full legalization. And let's look at how things have gone in the states, particularly Colorado, California, where we have full legalization. And all of those arguments were made in those states, by the way, before those states legalized. So what about his point?
Well, in all this, so far as I know, you know, maybe the attorney general has a different opinion. But as far as I know, in all the states where it's been legalized so far, arrests are down, crime rates are down, revenues are up, taxes are up, graduation rates are up. People are smiling more. They're dancing in the streets, you know.
And, you know, as someone who writes regularly about this, yes. I would expect you to say that. And I want to give fair voice, though, to those who they're okay with medical legalization, yeah. Sally. They're not as comfortable with recreational legalization. You used to live in Denver, Colorado. So tell us what it's like there in a place now where for some time they've had full legalization, and you can get it everywhere.
Absolutely. Well, you can get it into an adult use dispensary with your 21 and older license. It is regulated like alcohol there, and I think that's a key point to make. There are not people smoking in the streets. In fact, it's illegal to smoke in the streets. Public consumption is illegal in Colorado, which is actually a problem because people could get the marijuana and they have nowhere to smoke it except for the privacy of their own home. But all of these naysayers, though, the world is going to come to an end arguments, just never came to fruition. Teen use is down. In fact, you take away the coolness of marijuana, teenagers see their parents, you know, reason
they don't want to do it as
they
much.
Literally they're like, I don't want to smoke pot, my parents do that, that's uncool.
Interesting. Here's an email from a listener. David says he saw a petition to legalize medical marijuana or legalize marijuana recreationally in Florida. One of the questions asked for your voter registration number. Most people don't know that. Would that mean your signature wouldn't count if you sign without it?
No, you don't have to have the voter registration number. I think you can put your Social Security number and your birth date there as well.
And here's a Facebook comment from Susan. I've heard that in places where cannabis was legalized, death by opiate overdose decreased.
That is true.
And so more people turn toward cannabis for pain relief.
Absolutely.
We're seeing rather than opiates.
Yes.
Right?
And in a place like Florida, the caller earlier was talking about a cut version of morphine. I think more opiates in Northeast Florida is the last thing that anyone wants. And I also wanted to point out that no matter how legal it is, you're not going to have your cab drivers on marijuana. You're certainly not going to have pilots or people operating heavy machinery on marijuana. That's never going to happen. Even if Jimmy Buffett is your pilot, he won't be high when he's flying.
Let's go to Chris in Arlington. Hi, Chris. Good morning. Hey, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling in response to a caller that called in previously about his reasons for not wanting to legalize recreational marijuana, such as, you know, you don't want your doctor high as he's working on you surgically, and you don't want your pilot high as he's flying your plane. I'm a blue-collar trade guy. I've been working in the field, and OSHA has not changed their stance on marijuana. Even in Colorado, California, and the states have passed recreational marijuana use. If you piss test and comes back positive, you're automatically terminated. So nothing has changed on those aspects. I just wanted to call and give that a little bit of information. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for that. And, you know, I appreciate all the callers with their perspectives on this. And I want to also point out in other cannabis news, down in Palm Beach County, the state attorney there put police on notice. He told them that marijuana arrests are going to be tougher now that hemp is legal in Florida. Sally Kent Peebles, let's talk about that. Hemp is a related product. It is not the same as medical marijuana, but it has essentially been legalized in Florida. And that's important to mention as well.
Absolutely. So hemp and marijuana are both cannabis sativa. However, hemp is legal at both the federal and now, as of July 1st, at the state level. The key to understand here is that when you burn them, the smell, it's impossible to differentiate between the two. So before this comment, you know, the smell of marijuana, when a police officer walks up to your car, that gives them probable calls to do a warrantless search of your vehicle. And now Palm Beach County officers are being told they can no longer use the smell of marijuana to as an excuse to search a vehicle. It really takes away one of their tools. And I think this is an excellent opportunity not to try to fix it by providing some tests for them to be able to differentiate between the two. Instead, this should be an opportunity to talk about the fact that people should not be arrested for marijuana and really address these outdated laws on the books of Florida.
Yeah, and police departments around the state are moving away from this because they have better things to spend their money on. They have, you know, cybercrime, sex trafficking, you know, opiates, as we've talked about. Actually, my old boss at Folio, Ann Schindler, did a story for First Coast News just today about JSO is warning people to be careful about doing CBD products. CBD products are made from hemp because some of them may contain trace amounts of THC. I can understand where, now this hasn't happened yet, but I could totally see how a trafficker could use the hemp provisions as a means of like shipping in like actual cannabis, but I don't quite see that happening yet.
At the same time, CBD has taken off like a rocket around the state. Consumers are using it to help with anxiety, pain, depression, insomnia. Yeah. It's not regulated, so a word to the wise, just make sure that you're buying a high-quality product. How can people check to make sure of that?
Well, great news. As of July 1st, the Florida hemp farming bill went into place, and the Department of Ag issued hemp rules, and part of those rules are going to set regulations around CBD. So while it's not regulated now, Nikki Fried and the Department of Ag are making it a priority to set standards that people who are selling it or making it in the state of Florida will have to abide by. So we'll have more clarity if a label says, you know, this has amount of CBD, this has the toxins, you know, it'll all be tested, and you'll be able to clarify that by the label and have some certainty when you're taking it.
Always good to have your cannabis insights on the show. Lots of news this week. So thank you, Sally Kent Peebles, on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Columnist Shelton Hull, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, Moms for Clean Water ramps up a new political fight in Florida. That's in our Going Green. We'll be right back.
By the time today's babies are 80 years old, the sea is projected to have risen up to 6.5 feet. So what's being done to protect life on the First Coast? At ADAPT from WJCT, you'll find stories about adaptation by everyone from the Navy to realtors and the city of Jacksonville. Join us now at adaptflorida.org.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact 358-6327 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today. Join us on July 18th for Chasing the Moon, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a conversation, an interactive discussion on the impacts the space program and lunar landing have had on humanity. For more information, visit wjct.org/events.
From doo-wop and oldies to acoustic music, listen to After Hours Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM, your community, your world, your music.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new campaign dedicated to restoring and protecting Florida's waterways. Moms for Clean Water is inspired by Florida's First Lady, Casey DeSantis. Lisa Reinemann is another mom. She's also the St. John's Riverkeeper. She's here now with more in our Going Green. Hey, Lisa, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And if you're concerned about algae blooms and water pollution, what are your thoughts and questions and your comments about Moms for Clean Water? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. So how did Moms for Clean Water come together as a statewide campaign?
So last year, the 13 waterkeepers across the state of Florida, we came together to create Waterkeepers Florida to make sure all of our waterways had a state voice. And we were meeting shortly after the governor's inauguration. And one of the things that really stood out is First Lady DeSantis. She said that really all of Florida kids deserve clean water. And we agree with her and want to make sure we're doing all we can to give her our support and encouragement to fight for clean water across the state.
So she's the nominal face of this campaign as a mother herself?
Yes, she was the inspiration because, you know, when we start looking at these environmental threats, issues, and opportunities through our kids' eyes, it really makes a difference. And so we believe that she can make a difference in being a leading voice on making sure that all kids across the state of Florida have access to swimmable, fishable waters.
Governor DeSantis and his wife are certainly more of an environmental mindset than their predecessor, Governor Rick Scott, and his administration. They've appointed a chief science officer to look at water issues and other environmental issues around Florida. At the same time, the most recent legislative session failed to yield any protective policies for Florida's waterways. And so what's the current state of affairs for waterways, particularly our own St. John's River, which is your job to protect and advocate for?
Exactly. Well, we are very encouraged by Governor DeSantis's executive order, his chief scientist, Dr. Tom Frazier. We've met with on river issues for the St. John's, and we're taking important first steps. The challenge we see, though, is we have a lot of ground to make up. We lost 4 decades worth of water quality protections and policy under Governor Scott. And now the legislature, as you mentioned, failed to make any improvements in that arena. And while they've dedicated funding to try to undo some of the pollution, we can't buy our way out of this problem. We have to make sure not only that we're focusing on projects to restore the water, but prevention to stop pollution in its source. And secondly, we have to protect all of Florida waters. There seems to be a priority on South Florida. In the Governor DeSantis' plan, we have to make sure he's addressing all of Florida's problems because sadly they're all experiencing toxic blue-green algae.
Let us know if you've seen blue-green algae in the river or tributaries. Give us a call, especially if you live on the water. It's 549-2937. We see these algae blooms every summer. This summer, didn't we start seeing them even earlier?
We did. We had our first outbreak on April 10th, the first reported one, and we've seen pop-ups throughout of 50% of the river. So more than 150 miles has been negatively impacted by blue-green toxic algae this year. And that's unacceptable. And we have to make sure that we're keeping the pollution out and preventing this from happening, because sadly, it's happening way too often.
And the algae is driven by nutrients. Let's explain, for those who haven't followed this, what drives these pollutants growing and festering in the river?
Sure. So algae occurs naturally, but what happens when there's too much nutrients, excess nutrients and nitrogen and phosphorus, then they do an outbreak and they have these toxins that are produced. And they're fueled by our excess fertilizers coming off our yard, coming off of agriculture areas, failing septic tanks, industry waste, wastewater treatment facilities. We are all part of the problem, but we can also be part of the solution by being river friendly and also asking for our elected officials to enact protective policies.
And what would you like to see the legislature do?
Well, we would like for them to, one, ban the harmful trucking of South Florida's sewage sludge to our waterway. Right now, they're they're forcing us to take someone else's pollution and deal with it. That's a
problem.
They're
dumping it in the river?
In the headwaters. They're disposing it on land. When it rains, it runs off into our waterways. So that's a new pollution source. On top of things like we need to make sure agriculture's being held accountable for best management practices, and they're actually monitoring water quality. We need to make sure we're buying land. Conservation land is one of the best ways to protect our waterways and buffer growth. And we just need to make sure our policies stop pollution before it enters into our waterways. And there's different tools the legislature can use to make that happen. But sadly, they did not do so this last year.
Do you think Moms for Clean Water can bring more leverage to bear on this issue?
Most definitely. But what we've put together is a website. And so you can go to stjohnsriverkeeper.org to weigh in as a mom and share your story. Why is clean water important to you? Or why are you upset because your waterways has blue-green algae scum on it and you can't access it? And by sharing our stories and working with First Lady DeSantis, we can give our waterways another voice in Tallahassee to make sure we're getting these protective policies.
As the governor has noted, Florida is a little different than other states when it comes to these environmental and water quality issues, because Florida, a tourism-driven state, touts its natural resources, its beautiful environment, as the economy. So there's less of a conflict between business interests and environmental interests in Florida than you might see in other states. But at the same time, the legislature is more commonly attuned to business interests than environmental voices like yours. So how do you look at that? How do you address that?
Well, we have to make sure they're looking at all costs associated with doing nothing. For example, the sewage sludge. If we do nothing and we allow the trucking of South Florida's waste to our watershed, there's a $200 million annual cleanup liability downstream. That number is normally not taken into account in a legislative setting. They have to look at the cost of doing nothing, and that's part of what we're working with the legislature and the governor's blue-green algae task force.
Moms for Clean Water represents moms across the state of Florida. They're calling for greater protection of all of our water resources, particularly for our kids. What are your thoughts and comments? And have you spotted that algae along the water where you live this summer? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Mark is on the west side right now. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, thanks.
The River Keeper mentioned something that they had a meeting with all the state river keepers, and I just wondered, did she mention or did she talk with the river keeper who is in charge of the Orlando area and talk to them about, or has she ever talked to them about taking the 100 million gallons of water for the St. Johns River to water their golf courses down there? I sort of had this mental image. I kind of hope it would have broken down to some sort of Three Stooges-like fight. But
I guess that makes you Lisa. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. Well, right, and that's a related issue. Thank you for that call, Mark. Central Florida basically wants to take North Florida's water.
Yes.
That's another fight you're having. And have you talked to them about that?
Well, yes. And actually, the St. John's River watershed covers Orlando. So I am the riverkeeper for the Orlando area for the St. John's. We do share the Kissimmee watershed as well. But we are working on that, and that's been something I've personally been working on for the 7 years I've been river keeper, because it does not make sense and will damage the St. John's River if they siphon more than 150 million gallons of water a day from the St. John's, because it pulls in more salt water that does damage to submerged grasses and wetlands, and those are the filters of our river that actually take out the pollution that's going in. So it's unsustainable, and we will fight any permit that's looking to withdraw water from the St. John's for Central Florida.
And that hasn't happened yet. They're trying to make that happen, correct?
That's correct. They did a water supply impact study, set, you know, trying to justify the withdrawals, but they only looked at quantity and not quality. And you can't offset the impacts by replacing fresh water with salt water. It doesn't make sense if you're looking at quality. And that's something we also want to make sure that all of the elected leaders are focusing on water quality, because that's what protects clean waters for all of our citizens.
Now, you're here to talk about Moms for Clean Water. But while you're here, let me ask you about some other matters you've been working on. Let's talk about the dredging project in the St. John's River that's designed to accommodate bigger cargo ships coming through the port. You, the riverkeeper, have sued to stop that dredging. What's the status of that lawsuit and the dredging itself?
So the dredging, sadly, is underway. They have piecemealed some of the money, basically forcing us to accept the project before we had our day in court. We're still waiting and going through the federal court process. Meanwhile, they're not offsetting the impacts. This dredging law increased saltwater intrusion, just like the water withdrawals in Central Florida. So it's hard to say we're against that, but we're accepting this harm here in the city. But it's also increasing or accelerating the impact of sea level rise. They're looking to see about a 5 to 8 inch increase in downtown Jacksonville immediately following this dredging and storm surge. And that's going to accelerate sea level rise in a community that's not aggressively dealing with sea level rise. And so it just adds insult to injury, but we're still fighting that in court as well.
But while you're fighting it, facts on the ground, or really under the ground, are moving ahead.
They are moving around. In fact, at some point, they're wanting to have like 8 dredgers out there. So we're inspecting and keeping an eye and make sure they're not doing anything outside of their permit, but also trying to accelerate the court process. Meanwhile, we're fighting for other projects that could offset the impact, like restoring tributaries, like resiliency efforts that will help buffer from sea level rise, but also help buffer from the impact. So we're taking multiple tracks trying to stop the dredging, hold them accountable to the harm they will cause, but also looking for ways to fortify our river from not only the dredging, but sea level rise in the future.
There's an adaptation action area working group, a committee that was mandated by the state to work here in Jacksonville to look at the long-term effects of flooding and storm surge and sea level rise. There's also a resiliency committee. Are you working in concert with those groups to try to better protect this area from these impacts?
Most definitely. We've attended every meeting that they've had and will continue to do so. We're also supporting legislation that's coming out of those meetings. There's legislation going through the city council process as we speak that's important first steps, but they're first steps. We have to continue to work with city council and also work with our mayor's office to do everything we can to protect our community, our business, our homes, and our St. John's River.
Let's go to Dave at the beaches. Hi, Dave. Good morning. How are you?
Morning, Melissa. Wanted to just amplify what Lisa's saying about the importance of prevention and a comprehensive approach to this. Almost 50 years ago in 1975, I did a 208 area-wide water quality management study for the city of Tallahassee. And we documented in 1975 that 50% of the nutrient loading into Lake Munson's and down Munson's slough was due to urban stormwater runoff. And the primary source of nitrogen in that runoff was from atmospheric deposition, meaning exhaust from the combustion of fossil fuels, from automobile exhaust, and so on and so forth. Back in the 70s, other folks did a huge comprehensive study on Tampa Bay, where the primary concern was sewage discharges into Tampa Bay, which they clamped down on. But another major source of nutrients was, again, atmospheric deposition of nitrogen oxides from the combustion of fossil fuels. So all these sources of air pollution, nitrogen oxides, even the greenhouse gases, are all part of the reasons why we have to have a comprehensive approach to not just this problem, but also the problem of sea level rise. it's all connected. And I really commend Lisa and you for putting this issue out on the front burner, because we have to have the public better informed as to how you can prevent these problems and not just react to them after the barn is burned down and the horse has escaped. And we're now we're trying to put Band-Aids on by hundreds of millions of dollars into projects that, frankly, are only Band-Aids, and they ignore the root cause of the problem. So,
thank you, Dave. Thanks for that. And let me also direct people to our new digital magazine, by the way, adaptflorida.org. If you go to adaptflorida.org, you will look at comprehensive reporting from our whole team here at WJCT, along with some reporting from around the state of Florida, looking at how this state is going to be facing these adaptation efforts over time, Lisa, which are going to only become more urgent.
Exactly. They're going to become more urgent and they're going to become more expensive. And so are we going to sit around as mothers or fathers or nanas and allow our kids to be burdened with this problem? Right now is the time we have to take a control of this and make sure that we're doing our best to protect our waters, to protect this planet and our community for future generations. And that's why we're calling on moms to stand up for clean water and unite to make sure we're doing everything we can for our children.
There's a website and there's a social media campaign. How can moms access all of this?
Sure. If you go to stjohnsriverkeeper.org, you'll find all the information on our blog. You can also like us on Facebook, and you can join in and share your stories. And like I said, we're bringing together moms from across the state. We had a roundtable discussion on Monday with moms in St. Augustine. And it's just beautiful stories about moms, how they experience the waters with their mothers and grandmothers, as well as what they envision for the future. So we ask moms to all join us in and share their stories.
Let's take one more call. It's Diana on the south side. Diana, hey, Diana, real quickly, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Diana. I'm letting you know that I have a sailboat and I spent a month going up and down the St. John's River in May. And expected to go to the Clear Springs, and the springs, all the water in Lake George was just chunky green with industrial waste floating over top of it. I never even got off the boat. It was so awful, and ended up coming back quickly. You know, I didn't pay for any docks. I didn't go to any hotel areas. I didn't go to any dinners down those areas. And nobody's looking after the river, but you will be happy to know that there were 8 border control boats going up and down the river, but nobody who was checking the water.
Oh, wow. Thanks for that, Diana. And so for anyone who loves being on the water or near the water, or you don't have to be a mom, this campaign is for you. The hashtag is Moms for Clean Water.
That's it. That's it. And please join us, because like Dana said, that we have to fight for these waters and get people to take notice and to stand up for them. And that includes all of us and our elected officials and our First Lady. So we appreciate her commitment to clean water and want to give her the support we can.
Lisa Reinemann is the St. John's River Keeper. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And up next, celebrating the moon landing and the future of space travel. How you can be part of it all this weekend at the library. We'll tell you how right after this. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Void Magazine's July 2019 drink issue is out, filling the void in Northeast Florida for nearly a decade. Void keeps your finger on the pulse of our region's unique culture and lifestyle. Available at over 400 locations. For more, voidlive.com.
The Trump administration says think about prescription drugs like you think about cars.
Since 1958, car companies have been required to post their sticker prices. There's no reason it should be any different for drugs.
But does that comparison work?
You're not negotiating with the pharmacist for the cost of your drugs.
In search of a better drug pricing analogy this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Randy Rainbow. He writes and performs satirical songs about President Trump set to the melodies of show tunes. His videos go viral on YouTube. Songs like this, borrowing a melody from The Wizard of Oz.
You would probably start crying, then rehash all the lying and rhetoric you've preached.
Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Senator Cory Booker says he would unite the country as our next president. But how?
You do everything you can to affirm the values of our country. And what you don't do is what we see coming from the presidency, which is rank racist rhetoric.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker answers your questions about his run for the White House next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a special treat this weekend at the Jacksonville Public Library in honor of Saturday's 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. Two huge space exploration theme programs are underway, and the theme is a universe of stories. We're pleased to welcome Ryan Emmons, e-services supervisor at the library. Good morning.
Good morning.
Bharath Muthiala is here. He's the NASA Solar System Ambassador. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Also in studio, Doug Bigalke, Network Security Specialist with Southern R2 Builders. And Doug brought another special guest with him into the studio, an R2-D2 model. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I can't wait to hear all about R2-D2. But first, Bharath, let's begin with you. At the library this weekend, there's going to be a tech fair and a talk by you on Project Artemis. This is NASA's next big project to take us to the moon and Mars. This is so exciting. Tell us what you'll be sharing with everyone.
Yeah, so we are doing this 50th anniversary, right? 50 years we know about the moon with the Apollo program. But NASA want to do the next generation of exploration, which is Artemis 1, 2, 3, like that Apollo 1, 2, 3. We have Apollo Artemis 1, 2, 3, 4, and goes on. So it's completely different from the Apollo program. So Apollo program is just, we go there, go to the moon, get the samples and do our research, whatever. But the Artemis is like sustainable development, like sustainable presence on the moon. So we'll go there. Actually, we build a gateway before going to the moon. We will have a gateway around the moon. So this gateway, like an International Space Station, it will be just like International Space Station orbiting around the moon. And that will be built over the time. We'll build that gateway and we'll go to gateway and then docking with the gateway and then from there do the research on the moon.
As soon as the year 2022, mm-hmm. you plan to take a crew around the moon for the first time in 50 years.
50 years. By 2024, that is the plan actually. First time
2024,
the first woman is going to land on the moon and then a man.
So how exciting is this?
Yeah.
And okay, so Ryan, when people come to the library, they'll get to hear Bharath's talk straight from NASA and about the future of space travel. They will also take part in a tech fair. Tell us about that.
That is correct. We are having a tech fair on Saturday, and it will be the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, so there will be a tribute to that. And we will have different technology stations throughout the library where kids can learn to code, they can learn to program robotics. And we have the most famous robot of all time, R2-D2, will be here. He will be the star of the show, probably. He's a big draw everywhere he goes. But this is a STEM event with a sci-fi twist to it.
Lots happening. And let's talk about the most famous robot in the world, Doug. You built R2-D2 himself, and you brought him here into the studio. There he is, saying hi. Okay, how long did it take you to build R2-D2 here. He looks exactly like the original R2-D2 from Star Wars.
Yes, it took me about a year and a half from start to having him done, but he's a constant work in progress. I change things out all the time as I learn new processes. It's, hey, let's upgrade them. So
this is going to be an incredible opportunity for kids and their parents to interact with your robot. What's it like when you bring him to events like this?
He's the star of the show. He's a diva. He gets all the attention. He's often the one who everyone stop and take a picture with, and they love him, hug him, and yep.
What all can R2 do besides he can talk? You just had him.
He can talk.
For
he can
us.
Move his dome, and I can drive him around. That's about all he can do because he goes to several events a year. Wolfson's Children's Hospital, zoo, the library this year, to mingle with the crowd and bring people smiles.
It's exciting because as we mark the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, Barath, our popular culture is also, you know, R2 is one example of how our popular culture is suffused with our fascination with going into space.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's Apollo 11, all the Apollo missions, they all inspired this new innovations, discoveries all over. So the Artemis plan is also the same thing. Like, we are going to create this innovation, new generation of scientists, new generation of people. It's all exciting.
The moon landing happened July 20th, 1969. So on the anniversary, people can come out to the library, Ryan, for the tech fair and the talk, Planets and Stars, from Barath, from NASA. This is free. How can people be part of all the fun at the library on Saturday?
Well, just come down. We start at 10 a.m. Parking's free. Just come right down to the main library.
This is going to be an incredible event for your kids. And even if you don't have kids, you should come this Saturday on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing to the Jacksonville Public Library's summer event, A Universe of Stories. Learn all about the next phase of space travel. Meet R2-D2. Take part in the tech fair and hang out with these guys. Thank you so much, Ryan Emmons with the library, Doug Bigalke, Southern R2 Builders, and Barath Muthiala, the NASA Solar System Ambassador. Thanks for being here, everybody.
Thank you.
Going to be a great event. And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. If you have feedback for us, we always want to hear it. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, a new book looks at the backbreaking conditions for warehouse workers at Amazon fulfillment centers, including here in Jacksonville. What are working conditions really like? We'll take a closer look. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, have a great day. When I'm seeking knowledge, either simple or abstract, the facts are with science. The facts are with science. Science is real. Science is real. Science is real. Science is real.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.